Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. In this episode, we explore evolving evidence on anticoagulation after atrial fibrillation ablation, long-term outcomes with immunotherapy for melanoma, and promising new treatments for hepatitis D and triple-negative breast cancer. We review advances in physiologic pacing for heart failure and work through a challenging case involving fever, rash, and neurologic symptoms. An article considers fairness for late-career physicians, and perspectives discuss misconceptions about autism, access to contraception, and the financial pressures shaping healthcare. A New Clinical Decisions addresses the approach to a policy issue. You are a gastroenterologist who has been asked to serve on a committee that will decide whether to make single-use duodenoscopes available for endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography at your institution. You must decide whether to advocate for the use of reusable endoscopes only or to recommend making single-use endoscopes available. What would you choose? Visit nejm.org to read the vignette and essays, and to vote. Antithrombotic therapy after successful catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation by Atul Verma from McGill University, Montreal, and co-authors. Catheter ablation is an established therapy for the treatment of atrial fibrillation and is superior to medical therapy in reducing the recurrence and burden of atrial fibrillation. A low burden of atrial fibrillation has been associated with a decreased risk of stroke, but it is unclear whether successful catheter ablation reduces the risk of stroke enough that the risk-benefit ratio does not support the need for oral anticoagulant therapy. Consequently, current guidelines state that anticoagulation should be continued indefinitely after atrial fibrillation ablation on the basis of the patient's stroke risk profile and not the apparent success of the procedure. This trial evaluated whether successful catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation eliminates the need for long-term oral anticoagulant therapy. 1,284 patients who had undergone successful catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation at least 1 year earlier and had a CHADS-2 VASC score of 1 or more, or 2 or more for women or for patients in whom vascular disease was a risk factor, were randomly assigned to receive either aspirin or rivaroxaban and followed for 3 years. Treatment with rivaroxaban did not result in a significantly lower incidence of a composite of stroke, systemic embolism, or new covert embolic stroke than treatment with aspirin. Christine Albert from the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, Los Angeles, writes in an editorial that these findings by Verma and co-authors are highly consistent with those of the anticoagulation 1 year after ablation of atrial fibrillation in patients with atrial fibrillation, ALONE AF trial, which involved 840 adults with risk factors for stroke 1 year after successful ablation for atrial fibrillation, who were randomly assigned to either discontinue or continue anticoagulant therapy. In the ALONE AF trial, a low overall incidence of stroke and an elevated risk of bleeding in the anticoagulation group were observed, results that were similar to those of the trial by Verma. Taken together, the data suggests that patients with atrial fibrillation who have a low to moderate risk of stroke, CHADS-2 VASC score of 2 or less, and undergo successful catheter ablation and monitoring for recurrent atrial fibrillation, have a low enough risk of stroke that continued use of oral anticoagulants may not be justified, particularly given the associated bleeding risks. However, continued surveillance for recurrent atrial fibrillation seems prudent. Whether these findings extend to patients with higher CHADS-2 VASC scores remains uncertain, and extrapolation to this higher risk population should be undertaken with caution. Nivolumab for resected stage 3 or 4 melanoma at 9 years by Paolo Acierto from the IRCCS Fondazione G. Pasquale, Naples, Italy, and co-authors. In the CheckMate 238 trial, patients with resected stage 3B, C, or stage 4 melanoma who were treated with nivolumab had longer recurrence-free survival than those who received ipilimumab. The authors now report on longer-term survival. At a minimum follow-up of nearly 9 years, the median duration of recurrence-free survival was 61.1 months with nivolumab and 24.2 months with ipilimumab. No new late adverse events were reported. The 9-year final data support a sustained finding of longer recurrence-free survival with nivolumab than with ipilimumab. Paul Chapman and Jed Walchuk from Weill Cornell Medicine, New York, write in an editorial that Acierto and co-authors conclude that the results of their study support the use of adjuvant nivolumab over adjuvant ipilimumab. This is a reasonable conclusion, but begs a more important question. In 2026, which patients with melanoma, if any, should receive adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor therapy? Physicians now have a role in helping patients to make a personalized decision about whether to opt for adjuvant anti-PD-1 therapy by balancing the risks of toxic effects with the benefit of longer relapse-free survival without a clear benefit regarding overall survival. Patients and their families deserve a complete discussion of the quantified benefits and the quantified risk of permanent adverse events. The field is moving beyond adjuvant immunotherapy for patients with stage 3 melanoma who have macroscopic regional metastases as practitioners embrace the use of checkpoint inhibitors as first-line therapy, followed by surgery, also called neoadjuvant immunotherapy. This approach has theoretical immunologic advantages over adjuvant immunotherapy. The recent randomized NADINA and SWOG S1801 trials showed a stark benefit of neoadjuvant ipilimumab plus nivolumab or pembrolizumab over adjuvant anti-PD-1 therapy in event-free survival. It is important to remember that we still await overall survival data from these trials, but these editorialists think that the data justify offering upfront checkpoint inhibitor therapy rather than surgery to patients with resectable stage 3 melanoma. Whether subsequent surgery is required is an appropriate question for a randomized trial. The results here and in other trials of adjuvant anti-PD-1 therapy provide a basis for thoughtful discussions with patients and their families about the risks and benefits of treatment. A phase 2 trial of tobevibart plus elebsiran in hepatitis D by Tariq Asella from the Hôpital Beaujon, Paris, France, and co-authors. Globally, hepatitis D virus, HDV, infection affects approximately 12 million persons. Chronic HDV infection, the most severe form of chronic viral hepatitis, is associated with increased risks of cirrhosis, hepatocellular carcinoma, and death, and has limited treatment options. HDV is a satellite RNA virus that requires hepatitis B virus surface antigen for entry and propagation within hepatocytes. Both tobevibart, a monoclonal antibody, and elebsiran, a small interfering RNA, target hepatitis B virus surface antigen. This phase 2 trial evaluated the efficacy and safety of tobevibart and elebsiran in the treatment of chronic HDV infection. 65 participants were randomly assigned to receive tobevibart plus elebsiran every 4 weeks or tobevibart monotherapy every 2 weeks. Tobevibart plus elebsiran, as well as tobevibart monotherapy, decreased HDV RNA, the virologic response, and alanine aminotransferase levels through week 48. Treatment with tobevibart plus elebsiran was associated with a decrease in the hepatitis B virus surface antigen level. In an editorial, Daryl Lau from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston, writes that the overall results of tobevibart plus elebsiran for chronic HDV infection are very encouraging. The combination has now received FDA breakthrough therapy designation, as well as European Medicines Agency priority medicines designation for the treatment of chronic HDV infection. The substantial decrease in hepatitis B virus surface antigen levels during treatment could be attributed to the combined effects of the drugs on reducing viral entry, inhibiting surface antigen production from covalently closed circular DNA, and optimizing neutralization and clearance of HBV and HDV, including HBV surface antigen subviral particles from integrated HBV DNA. A crucial unanswered question is whether these favorable virologic responses would be sustained after the completion of therapy. Future studies are needed to further understand the host-viral interactions and immune mechanisms of these agents on the various HBV and HDV genotypes. Such work would inform the most effective therapeutic combinations and treatment durations for this challenging disease. Sacituzumab govitecan plus pembrolizumab for advanced triple-negative breast cancer by Sarah Tolaney from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. Triple-negative breast cancer is an aggressive breast cancer subtype, and there is an unmet need to improve outcomes in patients with previously untreated programmed death ligand 1, PD-L1, positive, locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. In this Phase 3 trial, 443 patients were randomly assigned to receive sacituzumab govitecan plus pembrolizumab or chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. Sacituzumab govitecan plus pembrolizumab led to significantly longer progression-free survival than chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab among these patients.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians, because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple, to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers, so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Physiologic pacing in heart failure. A review article by Mihail Chelou from Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, and co-authors. Cardiac physiologic pacing, also known as cardiac resynchronization therapy, is indicated in patients with heart failure, reduced left ventricular ejection fraction, LVEF, of 50% or less, and either a high or anticipated high ventricular pacing burden or a wide QRS complex. Traditionally, physiologic pacing has been achieved with biventricular pacing, with a right ventricular lead and a coronary sinus branch lead. Randomized trials involving more than 10,000 patients with heart failure have shown clinical, exercise, and quality of life benefits associated with biventricular pacing, as well as improved LVEF and reduced mitral regurgitation and ventricular volumes. These benefits are greatest in patients with left bundle branch block and a QRS duration of 150 milliseconds or longer. Recent studies support targeting the bundle of His or the left bundle branch as an alternative cardiac physiologic pacing strategy. Ongoing randomized trials are expected to more clearly define the comparative efficacy and safety of conduction system pacing as compared with biventricular pacing. A 58-year-old woman with diplopia and fever. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Sheila Arvikar and colleagues. A 58-year-old woman presented with fever, a widespread rash, and horizontal diplopia 3 weeks after lumbar spine surgery. Her symptoms began with postoperative worsening of back and leg pain, for which she received glucocorticoids. She developed a fever and a hive-like rash on her limbs and trunk, as well as swelling of the right eyelid with double vision. Neurologic exam revealed right esotropia and cranial nerve deficits, and MRI showed enhancement along multiple cranial nerves. The patient's acute presentation with fever and worsening symptoms, despite the administration of glucocorticoid therapy, suggested an infection. The patient had no signs of surgical site infection, but she lived in tick-endemic coastal Massachusetts and frequently walked her dog in wooded areas. Serologic testing confirmed infection with Borrelia burgdorferi, and PCR revealed co-infection with Babesia microti. Her constellation of cranial neuropathies, likely radiculitis, and rash with systemic symptoms was consistent with Lyme neuroborreliosis, a neurologic manifestation of Lyme disease that may be accompanied by other tick-borne infections such as babesiosis. Promoting fairness in screening programs for late career practitioners. A Medicine and Society by Daniel Kramer from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston, and co-authors. Late career physicians are an integral part of the U.S. medical workforce. Nearly a quarter of practicing physicians in the United States are over 65 years of age, and they are serving at a time of overall physician scarcity. Older physicians bring valuable wisdom and expertise to patient care, but many will experience cognitive and physical decline that may affect their clinical skills. Among hospitals, interest has grown in mandatory screening programs that could proactively identify physicians whose ability to deliver safe care may be compromised before patient harm occurs. However, concerns among medical staff about late career physician programs have hindered their widespread implementation. For example, in 2020, Yale New Haven Hospital was sued by the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which alleged that its late career physician program constituted age and disability discrimination. These authors believe there is a strong case justifying deployment of mandatory late career physician programs to promote patient safety. Principles of medical ethics recognize that the interests of patients should be professionals' chief concern. Yet physicians also have interests related to being screened that deserve respect, and late career physician programs can and should protect these interests by ensuring procedural fairness. These authors recommend methods that would balance patient safety and physicians' interests. Challenging claims of an autism epidemic, misconceptions and a path forward, a perspective by Tara Eicher from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston, and co-authors. On September 24th, President Trump and members of his administration held a press conference to make a series of statements regarding autism, attributing the condition to acetaminophen use in pregnancy and to early childhood vaccination. The purported link between autism and vaccination has already been extensively debunked, and the literature suggesting an association between acetaminophen use and autism diagnosis does not support the causal claims being made by the White House. A great deal has already been written about the scientifically dubious nature of these claims. But beyond these specific inaccuracies lies a larger misunderstanding of rising reported autism prevalence over the past several decades. Although the President and Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., speak of an autism epidemic, the best available evidence suggests that the apparent increase in autism rates is predominantly attributable to shifting diagnostic practices, diagnostic substitution, broadened diagnostic criteria, increasing awareness, and the closing of diagnostic disparities based on race, socioeconomic status, and probably sex. Autistic people and their families deserve answers to their aspirations for improved services, medical care, and inclusion in society. Research programs can be designed to maximize the benefits for autistic people and their families by studying both causes and the most effective and meaningful services and supports in an appropriate balance. Such a constructive shift will not be accomplished, however, by means of alarmist claims about autism as an epidemic, chasing of ill-supported and debunked theories of causation, and further stigmatizing autism. Conflation of contraception and abortion. Implications for access to contraceptives. A perspective by Kimberly Chernobyl from George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, Washington, D.C. In July, the U.S. administration marked $10 million worth of contraceptives being housed in Belgium, which were originally intended to be distributed as international aid, for incineration. The justification for the planned destruction of the products was that the U.S. government would no longer supply abortifacient birth control under the guise of foreign aid. Along with being a waste of taxpayer dollars, the decision not to distribute the contraceptives for this reason promotes dangerous misinformation. Although attacks on contraception are unpopular with the general public in the United States, conflation of contraception with abortion exploits a long history of stigmatizing abortion, itself essential care, that should be treated no differently from other forms of health care. Furthermore, the conflation of contraception with abortion could restrict access to contraceptives for millions of people in the United States. Contraception prevents pregnancy, whereas abortion ends a pregnancy. This article warns that labeling contraceptives as abortifacients could affect the Hyde Amendment, Title X, and the ACA, undermining access to all forms of reproductive health care. The U.S. administration recently ignored a Freedom of Information Act request for information pertaining to their decision to destroy the contraceptives housed in Belgium, a telltale sign that they know the decision lacks factual basis and is now being sued over this decision. The medical profession and members of the public should continue to push back against this false narrative while continuing to advocate for access to all forms of reproductive health care. Pleading poverty, related party payments, and healthcare entities' financial health. A perspective by Erin Fuse Brown from Brown University School of Public Health, Providence, Rhode Island, and co-authors. In the United States, members of the public have been understandably concerned about the increasingly frequent reports of financial problems among healthcare entities. The collapses of the Steward Health Care System and Prospect Medical Holdings are high-profile examples of the many recent bankruptcies in the U.S. healthcare system. When hospitals and other healthcare facilities shutter, the implications for patients, staff, and the community can be devastating. Even when entities continue operating during and after bankruptcy proceedings, quality of care may decline. The federal government and state governments play important roles in alleviating these concerns by setting public insurance payment rates and offering targeted support, such as loan subsidies and special reimbursements, to institutions that serve essential community roles. A key barrier to effective government oversight and optimal allocation of scarce health care resources, however, is the increasing use of related party transactions between healthcare organizations and affiliated entities, such as real estate or management companies, owned by the same parent company. Related party transactions are financial arrangements in which a healthcare organization pays an affiliated entity, such as a real estate management or services company. These transactions can be structured to shift profits or assets away from the care-delivering entity, for example, through inflated rents or fees, making the organization appear financially distressed, while related parties capture earnings elsewhere. The 25th anniversary of a nearly unknown health policy turning point. A perspective by Jerry Avorn from Harvard Medical School, Boston. The year 2025 marked the 25th anniversary of a campaign that played a major role in shaping U.S. health policy, but is scarcely remembered. In the late 1990s, Massachusetts faced the world's highest per capita medical care costs, while many people in the state had no medical coverage at all. amid growing concern about profit-driven companies and corporate control over physicians' decisions. A group of clinicians created a ballot initiative to establish a system of universal health care coverage for all state residents. Although the initiative was narrowly defeated after an extensive media and direct mail campaign by insurers and large businesses, it has had lasting effects. It helped prompt subsequent reforms that led Massachusetts to become the first state to guarantee health care coverage to all residents, and it provided a template for President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010. A quarter century later, the effort stands as a pivotal development in the ongoing quest to provide access to medical care to all the nation's residents and offers useful lessons on the promise and challenges of citizen-driven efforts to reform our still-struggling healthcare system. In our images in clinical medicine, a 60-year-old man with recently diagnosed HIV infection presented with a 10-day history of fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath. A CT scan of the chest showed diffuse nodules and ground glass opacities. Gomori methenamine silver staining of bronchoalveolar lavage fluid showed multiple round structures with thick walls, a finding consistent with the cystic form of the fungus Pneumocystis jirovecii. In another image, a 20-year-old man presented with an itchy rash 2 months after starting a ketogenic diet. Examination showed symmetric erythematous papules and underlying reticulated hyperpigmentation on the chest, neck, and shoulders, a diagnosis of prurigo pigmentosa, also known as keto rash, was made. This inflammatory dermatosis manifests as pruritic erythematous papules on the chest, back, or neck, and may progress to a reticular pattern over time. As in this patient, it has been associated with ketosis in the context of ketogenic diets, diabetes mellitus, and fasting. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.